Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants' lines are in an open and talk mode. If you need to mute your line, please press star 6. This conference is also being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect your line at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Christian Evans. Thank you. You may begin.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Chaplain Webinar Group Webinar. My name is Christian Evans. I am a Senior Program Analyst in the Psychological Health Promotion Branch of the Defense Health Agency Psychological Health Center. And I'm also the point of contact for the Chaplain's Work Group Webinars. Today's presenters are Dr. Timothy Hoyt, who is the Branch Chief for the Psychological Health Promotion Branch, and Chaplain Valeria Vandress. So before we start, I will go through a couple of housekeeping details and then introduce our speakers. As mentioned, we are recording a webinar, so if you have any objections, please disconnect now. We will take questions at the end of the presentation. For those of you who like to ask questions of the presenters, you can submit them through the chat features of Adobe Connect, or you can wait to the end of the presentation and ask your questions via the phone. You are invited and encouraged to talk among yourselves during the presentation in the chat feature, but we do ask that you refrain from posting any marketing, promotions from organizations, or products in the chat box. And finally, I ask that you mute your phones during the presentation. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's presenters. Dr. Timothy Hoyt is currently the Branch Chief for the Psychological Health Promotion Branch at the Psychological Health Center of Excellence. He was commissioned as an officer in the Medical Service Corps of the United States Army in 2007 and left active duty in 2014 to become a civilian supervisor and faculty member at Madigan Army Medical Center. And he's also a recipient of the Bronze Star for service in Afghanistan, as well as the Peter J.N. Linnaroos National Service Award from the American Psychological Association. And our second presenter is Chaplain Valeria Vandress. She is currently the First Center of Excellence Command Chaplain for the U.S. Army Medical Center of Excellence at Fort Sam Houston, Texas. She began her service as chaplain in 2004, serving as a squadron chaplain with the 4th Aviation Squadron in the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, Fort Polk, Louisiana, and deployed to Al-Qut, Iraq, 1 month after graduating from Chaplain Basic Course. Her military awards and decorations include the Bronze Star Medal, Meritorious Service Medal with 3 Oak Leaf Clusters, Army Commendation Medal with 1 OLC, Army Achievement Medal with 2 OLC, Good Conduct Medal, National Defense Medal, Afghanistan Campaign Medal with Star, Global War on Terrorism Expeditionary Medal, Global War on Terrorism Service Medal, Korea Defense Service Medal, the Army Overseas Ribbon with numeral 2, and NATO Service Medal. And our disclosure statement, the views expressed in this presentation are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of Defense nor the U.S. government. Presenters have no relevant financial relationship to disclose relating to the content of this activity. And now I turn it over to Dr. Hoyt.
Thanks, Christian. I really appreciate the introduction and everybody being here to join us for our quarterly chaplains webinar. This is always a unique opportunity because, for the last several years, we've gotten to do these and really combine our efforts in terms of what chaplains and unit ministry teams can do when partnering directly with mental health assets and taking care of our service members and veterans. Today's topic is confidentiality, which I think we would all agree is a very foundational principle in medicine in general and behavioral health in particular, all the way from the sacred secrets of the ancient Greeks all the way up to the APA ethics code today. It's crucial that we're maintaining the confidentiality of our patients in order to get them to open up to us and to overcome some of the stigmatizing things that get in the way of service members seeking mental health care. However, we've always got this wrinkle when we're providing mental health care in the military because federal regulations and the military exception to HIPAA provide limited confidentiality in certain military settings. Several specific exemptions are delineated under and can be found in DOD M 6025.18. These include things like medical treatment and oversight, command notification in certain situations when there might be threat to mission, perceived threats to safety, which may be reporting to a command when a service member is a threat to themselves or others, public health surveillance purposes, such as maintaining registries or tracking down other public health information, judicial and administrative proceedings where certain behavioral health information might be admissible under military laws of evidence, law enforcement investigations when records may be subpoenaed, minimal risk research where no additional where confidentiality might be breached without additional consent, and some specialized military personnel programs that allow for the collection of certain aspects of a behavioral health record or assessments that then go toward whether or not a candidate may be selected. So when concerned about all of these things, service members often endorse that they're very worried about seeking care because of all these things, because of these factors. In fact, we know that patients don't really read our informed consent documents well, and they might be surprised when they find out that there can be limited confidentiality in behavioral health settings. And so one of their best assets to go to has often been perceived as the chaplain, who has much greater protection and confidentiality in military settings. And so that provides the background, the sort of backdrop for our presentation today. And I'll now turn it over to Chaplain Van Dress to talk some more about confidentiality when we're in more of a situation collaborating with the chaplain. Chaplain Van Dress, over to you.
Thanks, Dr. Hoyt. Good morning, everyone. Yeah, it's a real honor to be here with you today. This is a topic that is obviously near and dear to everyone who's a chaplain, because it's one of the reasons why people will come talk to a chaplain as opposed to talking to someone else. It's one of the reasons why people might come to a chaplain as opposed to behavioral health. But thankfully, most of us chaplains are well-versed in referring, and so we refer when we need to behavioral health and work in tandem and very well with our behavioral health partners. And so with that, I just wanted to begin by just giving a couple of definitions. Really, you know, when we talk about definitions of words, because words matter, words mean something, and if you're looking at the screen, communication, I think everyone knows what that means when we talk about communication. But when we talk about confidential communication, now this is where we get into what it means to look at doctrine, regulation, law, and what official DOD instructions and such say about what chaplains can consider as confidential communications. And if you can see on your screen here, it's communication if it's made either as a formal act of religion or as a matter of conscience, and then it's considered confidential if it's made to the chaplain in our capacity as a spiritual advisor. Or this also includes not just the chaplain, but our religious affairs specialist, which was prior, used to be known as the chaplain assistant. So it's this communication that's not intended to be given to third persons. And then, of course, I think most everyone knows that privileged communications just means it's, you know, can be used in a court of law, but when it's privileged, it will not be used. It's protected in and out of legal context, as it says on your screen there. So that's the one thing that is specific to the chaplains. Now, here, if you just look at this picture, you can kind of see with sensitive information, I think everyone is also familiar with, you know, that's like, if people go to AA meetings or something like that, we want to keep that sensitive. It's not necessarily confidential, but it's sensitive. And so you have that, you have confidentiality, and then the privileged communication. And I always ask when I'm teaching a class to my behavioral health students here, you know, who does the privilege belong to? And the overwhelming answer should be the counselee, right? Because whatever anybody shares with the chaplain, the privilege belongs to that person. It doesn't belong to the chaplain who's speaking. So just wanted to show that to you there. And then really, this slide here is kind of where I wanted to just touch on these four things, the historical foundations of why we have this confidentiality. And the greater good of society is just basically saying that there's a potential good that comes from people coming forward and eventually getting help, which outweighs the potential harm for allowing certain relationships to be protected. So you have the husband and wife relationship, the attorney-client, the doctor-patient, the clergy-penitent, the counselor-client, right? Those are the relationships that are protected for the greater good of society. And then you have a couple of court cases, Supreme Court decisions. Basically, Trammell versus U.S. is probably the most known one. The Supreme Court recognized the human need to disclose to a spiritual counsel in total and absolute confidence. So that the court decided that when it's believed to have, somebody is believed to have flawed acts or thoughts, and to be able to receive priestly consolation and guidance in return. So the Supreme Court decided that you can have total and absolute confidence. And again, those words mean something. And then also probably the most famous one I think most chaplains know, U.S. versus Moreno. And I believe I have a slide here to explain that one. Too far. So that one, again, it's just saying that the clergyman reflects an accommodation between the public's right to evidence and the individual's need to speak with that counselor. Again, there's those words, in absolute confidence. So those are Supreme Court decisions. And then next we have the military rules of evidence. Going back to this slide, the military rules of evidence 503. Basically, again, it's a general rule of privilege, and the definition of a clergyman is a minister, priest, rabbi, chaplain, or other similar person of a religious organization who is reasonably believed to be so by the person consulting that person. So those are military rules of evidence. And then, of course, AR-165-1, that is the military army regulation that obviously lies out confidentiality in paragraph 16-1. And then finally, before we open it up, I just wanted to mention the Chief of Chaplains policy, which is also important. As you can see there are no exceptions, because people always want to ask, okay, chaplain, well, what about if somebody, you find out that they're abusing their child, or somebody just committed a crime, or somebody says they're going to threaten to kill their first sergeant? Are you telling me that your confidentiality is complete and absolute? And if you see right here, yes, it is complete and absolute. There are no stated exceptions. And as you can see here, we only reveal when we have been given consent, and it has to be a specific consent. And as you can see, you know, sexual assault coordinator, we might thought to be required to report something, but we are not. We are not required to report. And I got one more here. So here's the general rule. Unless we know, right, we want to assume that this person consider this to be a matter of religion when they're speaking to us, and they intend the conversation to be confidential. And it's their intention, not my theology, that determines whether it's confidential, where it's confidential or not. It's also not a lawyer's call to decide if they're talking is confidential. And the bottom line there, unless you're absolutely sure something's not confidential, don't speak. And so those are the basic general rules and the overview for chaplains. And so I just wanted to throw out to you, you know, if a suicidal soldier comes to me and tells me that they are going to kill themselves, they have a plan, they have a gun, it's in the car, and they come to me, what am I going to do? And that's pretty much the question that I get usually from people, especially I teach the behavioral health Bullock students here at the Medical Center of Excellence, and so they always ask that question, well, what are you going to do? And I think any chaplain that is in this group would probably answer very similarly. We would talk them off the ledge as best we can and discuss what it is that's going on with them and do everything we can to get them to refer, to want to go seek help. And we don't leave them. We don't say, okay, well, gosh, you know, this, you're safe with me. You know, I'm glad you shared this. Now go ahead on back and, you know, hope everything's okay. I'll pray for you. You know, that's not what we would do. I've only had three in my specific experience where I've had people expressly say they had a plan, they were going to kill themselves. And each one of them allowed me to either call their squad leader or allowed me to walk them over to the emergency room. So if somebody is sharing that deep hurt with the chaplain, it's usually because they want help. And so the chaplain is a safe place where they can share all of their ugly garbage and the things that are hidden in the closet, all the skeletons, and be able to get that off their chest and then be able to go and get the help that they need. So with that, I will turn it back over to Dr. Hoyt and open it up for any questions or whatever Dr. Hoyt wants to take it from here.
All right. Well, encourage everyone, start typing in your questions. Every difficult scenario you've ever encountered, let's stump the experts here with your most complicated things. Please type that into the chat. But otherwise, you know, I'd like to explore a little more of this condition where you're talking about, you know, the sort of initial sharing with the chaplain, almost as preparatory behavior, that it's clear that they wanted to seek care. They're disclosing some sort of thoughts of suicide or a plan. And I guess from speaking from your experience, chaplain, it sounds like they are typically okay with, after they've gotten that out in the open, that you're going to help walk them through care that they could really have sought on their own. And so I just wondered, what other thoughts do you have about the function of that? Like, why would it be so important to first get those thoughts out in a safe manner and then be equally willing to then go with the chaplain or have someone there with them to support them in going to the emergency room? What are your thoughts?
Well, that's a really good question, because I think another thing that one of the main functions that the chaplain provides is hope, right? We shine the light on hope. And anyone who's ever had the assist training knows that there's a death side of things and then there's a life side of things. And so what we try to do is focus on the life side and to get people to see, okay, is what it is that you're going through really that hopeless? Is there no way out? You know, looking 5 years down the road, is there really no hope for you? And so to get people to explore what else is going on inside and then to see, okay, is it something that they have done that they just feel that they can't be forgiven for, that it's just so bad that no one could ever forgive them, God couldn't even forgive them, and to walk them through forgiveness, or maybe it's guilt or shame or a habit or some kind of a temptation that they just continuously give into, and they think that they could never be treated for it or overcome that strong desire. And then to know, look, there's other people that have gone through very similar situations. You know, there's AA, and then we also have this Celebrate Recovery. It's a Christian program to help people with addictions or other things that they're struggling with. you know, I've had a LGBTQ person come to me with some very heavy struggles that they're going through, and they just felt that there was no way out because of the way they were created, which doesn't match how they feel. And just to talk through and walk through that, you know, it's sometimes people believe things that might not necessarily be accurate or true. And so walking through people and giving them that hope to know there is care, there is people who care. And it might be that you might need medication for your depression. It might mean that you need something to help you sleep because of your nightmares and your PTSD. You know, it's not the end of the world. And so to help people just talk through what it is they're going through after they get that off their chest, then they can see, you know, wow, you know, maybe there is hope for me. That's how I would answer that.
I really like that, particularly that idea of exploring, like, you know, the spiritual side first of, you know, if I'm having suicidal thoughts, has that been, in, you know, in certain religious traditions, maybe condemned by God, and you're giving them that hope to say, no, we're going to get you past this, and there is forgiveness for, you know, struggling with these thoughts. Looks like we've got a couple of good questions also coming up in the chat. I'll grab one of these, kind of a similar question, but how would your approach change when a soldier might admit to physically abusing their children or their spouse? This coming from Chaplain Wolf.
Hi, Chaplain Wolf. Yes, that's another one of the good questions that I probably should have led off with one of those as well. I've only dealt with one situation in my career where I had somebody actually admitting domestic violence. Thankfully, that person also wanted to get help, and I was able to refer that person to the victim advocate with their spouse, and they went and actually got some help. Again, it was I would do the same thing as I would do for anybody else to say, you know, this situation is a dangerous, unsafe situation, and, you know, I obviously would talk through all of the other theological discussion about how this looks according to their faith tradition and what that looks like and where, again, looking into the future. What is the future? What do you see the future like for you? You know, is this where you want to be in a year from now, in 5 years from now? You know, you could go to jail, you know, and just talk through all of the potential outcomes and get them the help that they need. The one person that I did talk to that was being abusive to his spouse, now it wasn't his child, so I don't have specific experience with that, but he was actually willing to go talk to and have his wife get the care that she needed, and so they were separated. He was placed into the barracks, and it was pretty scary. For a little bit, we didn't know what was going to happen to him, but he got the help that he needed, and they eventually stayed together, which was, you know, that was kind of a touch and go situation. But he did. He agreed to confess and to get help because he knew that the road he was going down could have ended in murder or you know. I mean, I wouldn't say something worse, but it could have ended in the unthinkable.
Yeah, I really like that approach again with, you know, really exploring, you know, the sort of journey, the pathway that the patient is on in that scenario, and then, you know, encouraging them to walk that back, you know, rather than, you know, I think on the behavioral health side, we might really have that, you know, drive to very first then, well, we've got to get on the phone, we've got to call family advocacy, you know, rather than exploring some of those reasons for, well, why did you come to me today with this? We'll pull up the next question here. This is from Chaplain Schwartz. Describing a scenario in which the soldier made suicidal statements to behavioral health personnel, but then went to the ER and downplayed those statements, saying, you know, maybe I'm not really suicidal. But then after that, after he got out of the ER, I guess, the command wanted the chaplain to meet with him as well. And he's wondering, is there any degree to which he could share with command after meeting with the soldier, considering that the soldier was already made aware of the situation by a behavioral health counselor in the course of those duties? Any thoughts on that?
So, again, we have absolute confidentiality. So I would say no. But, again, remember, if the soldier was speaking to the chaplain believing that what they were saying was confidential, then no. But what I would do, here's what I would do. I would, if my soldier wanted me to share something with my command, I would ask the soldier, hey, let's go talk to your commander. I'll go with you. I'll be happy to share, which I have done on several occasions, and they feel more comfortable having me spill the beans, so to speak, with them right there. And so that's what's been helpful for me. Now, if the command and if the behavioral health person already said that the soldier is suicidal, and then they're asking me, what do I think? What did they say to me? I would simply say, you know, my spiritual assessment of the situation is, and I would give my assessment, you know, I would say a high level of spiritual distress. And, you know, I think if the behavioral health counselor is recommending treatment, I definitely support that. That's kind of how I would say that. But I would never share anything that the soldier shared with me unless they were there in the room or specifically said that they wanted me to. Over.
That's great. I love that sort of line of reasoning there as well. Next, I think, similar kind of question, and this gets back into some of the legal precedents you cited. What about the Tarasoff ruling or the Tarasoff case that established the duty to warn? I know for behavioral health providers, that's very substantial finding in that even if we've identified a potential victim, we have to take more specific steps to warn them about perhaps statements that were made to us in the course of therapy. How has the chaplain community wrestled with the Tarasoff decision and their other duties? Over.
Yes. Well, that doesn't really apply to the chaplain corps. So the chaplain corps is a federal entity, Department of Defense, that has the absolute and complete confidentiality, and so it's not applicable in terms of something that we would absolutely have to do.
Yeah, and I think that calls out a great area of comparison there between, you know, behavioral health and the chaplains, where the chaplains would still hold that as a sacred duty to keep that in confidence, although it sounds like there may be additional ways to encourage the service member in this case, if you are thinking of harming someone specific, that, that is something to approach your command with, that is something to, potentially reach and seek help for, but where the chaplain would not have any responsibility to be trying to get a hold of that identified person and make any disclosures.
Yes. Well, I do want to say one other thing, and I think it's in, I wish I would have had it on a slide. I think it's in AR 165-1. It might even be in this presentation. Let me see. So if somebody says they're going to do something, is different than confessing sin. So I don't know if that's kind of what Chaplain Schwartz, or I'm sorry, not Chaplain Schwartz, Mr. Beasley is getting at, and I don't have that with me. Where is it at? Yes. I can't find it right here in my notes, but there is a difference if somebody says that they are going to do something, but they haven't done it yet, then is that considered confidential? And that's kind of one of those gray areas with the chaplains where we have a little bit of leeway in actually saying something about that. Gosh, but I don't know where that is. I actually know where that is. That's in the military rules of exception. 503 is where that states. Yeah. It's in MRE 503 that it states that specifically, that that is a possible exception if somebody tells you something that they're going to do because they haven't done it yet. So if they're telling you that they're going to do something, why are they telling you that? You know, why would, because they're not confessing their sin at that point, right? So, yes, I've come across that. I've never experienced that personally. I don't know, there's several other chaplains I see on here. I don't know if anybody ever experienced, you know, where somebody said, I'm actually going to go rob a bank and then I'm going to kill everybody in there or whatever. And, had a situation like that.
So I guess I'm wondering, as you say that, would that be under that exception under MRE 503 that this might be intended then to be disclosed to third persons? Like, is the service member telling you for the purpose of, you know, I'm feeling dangerous, you should warn these people, in which case then, you know, that is not a privileged communication per se. That is telling the chaplain, you know, you should warn these other people. I don't know. I could see it something like that.
Yes. And again, that's one of those, that's that gray area that they speak of. But, you know, again, I would do everything I can to help that person confess that exact same thing to their squad leader or to go to behavioral health and discuss it, you know, with them. That's how I would approach that. So I don't know if anybody else that's watching has anything. I don't see any comments on that.
Well, keep watching the chats. Feel free, anybody, to come on the line and let us know if you've got any additional wrinkles to explore with, you know, Tarasoff and duty to protect a disclosed victim. Another good question coming in here from Jim Martin, where some chaplains might hold professional credentials in behavioral health and might simultaneously be licensed for practice. Any thoughts on how they might deal with these sort of dual relationship challenges, particularly if that contact is, or that contact is occurring within more of a counseling versus a chaplain in religious context? Maybe they're practicing family therapy or counseling with a religious bent. Any thoughts about that?
Well, it depends on what role they're playing at the time. So if they're acting as a DOD chaplain for the military services, then they are bound by the federal law under the chaplaincy. But if they're acting as a behavioral health provider, then they would be bound by that because it's just like the National Guard. The National Guard belongs to the governor of the state, not the president of the United States, like the active duty chaplain. So if the state says our chaplains will report, will have a duty to warn, because states can make those laws for their prison chaplains, their hospital chaplains, etc. And so if a military chaplain is serving in the National Guard under the governor, you would think, well, they are under the law of the state. But that is not true, because the chaplain is a trained and a part of the Department of Defense, and they will still be bound by the same confidentiality as an active duty chaplain. So depending on what role they're in, what does the client or patient see the chaplain as? Are they visiting them with a cross or the tablets or the crescent moon on their uniform? Are they wearing a uniform with that on their collar, so to speak? It's on our chest now. Or are they serving in the role of the behavioral health person? That's where the delineation would be.
Yeah, I like that distinction in terms of, you know, really I think in those situations it'd be very important to lead off any session with a clear distinction of this is the role that I play right now. Because I guess from a medical legal perspective, if you have entered into a patient role for the purpose of counseling, you know, such that you would disclose limits to confidentiality prior to starting a session, you would inform them that this will be documented in some kind of therapy notes or medical record, that would much better establish which side of the fence the practicing chaplain is on right then. So they may be in a situation where they're saying, you know, we right now are in the midst of behaviorally focused counseling, which does not afford the same protections as it might if we were having, you know, a religious discussion about confession. But being very clear up front about which role that is, I think, can also help in those ambiguous situations. Although I agree, secondarily, that if that hasn't been well clarified, you put a little more gray area into, you know, if someone is disclosing, say, something that involves a duty to warn, your state license would require disclosure of that, making sure that that person is in a patient role at that point. I think we got two good questions here coming up from the same sort of question. What about law enforcement and first responder chaplains that might be called onto the local military base along with first responders? I can see several scenarios in which those who are affiliated with law enforcement might be there for a disaster of some kind or responding to an incident. Anything come to mind for that, chaplain?
Well, again, who is their authority? If they are Title 10 chaplain, military chaplain, then they fall under the rules of the DOD instructions and all the Army regulations and the military rules of evidence. But if they are a civilian just happening to be responding to something on a military installation, no, they wouldn't automatically be deemed as military personnel working for the federal government. They are still working for whoever they're working for. If they're an EMT or, you know, police, fire, civil, municipal services, then they fall under the rules and laws that govern that particular entity and organization.
So they wouldn't automatically inherit the permissions of a military chaplain just because they happen to be operating there. They would still go based on their whatever their first responder type chaplain role defines in terms of the limits to confidentiality.
That is correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. Title 10 applies to uniformed personnel on active duty.
Okay. Looks like another question had come through a little earlier. About military suicide rates, and I think this gets maybe a little further away from the current topic, but something that we can probably both speak to is, you know, what are we doing wrong if military suicide rates continue to kind of be unchanged? Any thoughts from your perspective, Chaplain, about what more we could do in terms of suicide prevention in the military?
Well, that's kind of a loaded question for me. I have a couple thoughts on that. You know, we continue to do suicide prevention training, and in fact, I'm just leading another working group that we just started this month, and we've, instead of calling it suicide prevention, we're now calling it life worth living. And so we're doing life worth living training rather than suicide prevention training, because we're focusing on the positives rather than on we're preventing death, right? We're talking about, why do you want to live? And so this is something new that we're trying because, like Dr. Brown says, what we're doing doesn't seem to be working. Now, society also has an increase in suicides, and usually the military mirrors the society. So it's going up in non-military circles as well. But one of the things that I personally, and, you know, I don't know if there's attribution on this recording, but one of the things that I think that we don't talk about enough, and I would use the word sin, S-I-N, but because that's a religious term, as a pastoral care provider, that's the word that I would use. But I think a lot of times is people don't want to look at, take responsibility for what it is that's going on in their life, and we want to blame people. And especially here in AIT land, when we have a lot of young soldiers that are coming in with suicidal ideations, so not completed, but suicidal ideations, typically it's because their boyfriend or girlfriend broke up with them. And so we call it, it's expectation management is really what these folks need, whereas I would call it, okay, let's look at and see what are we doing to contribute to the feeling of this hopelessness. And when I talk to people, and it's so interesting to me because I've been thinking through this over the last 2 years since I've been here at the Medical Center of Excellence, and the people that I've talked to when I'm down in the trainee land talking about their feeling like there's no hope, it's because they either have this bitterness and unforgiveness in their heart that they will not forgive somebody who's hurt them. And so they want to take it out on that person by killing themselves. And I've seen that. I think I've been here 2 years. I don't know. I've probably seen 40, 50 trainees here. And I've had like four of them share, you know what, yeah, That's absolutely, I don't want to forgive. And then they're like, I never thought about that. And so just kind of navigating people into what is it, again, what is causing your guilt? Why are you ashamed? What are these things? And again, as a pastoral care provider, I use the word sin. Now, depending on what the client, if they're not a religious person, then obviously I won't use religious speak with them. I'll use whatever their faith or non-religion words to mirror back what they're saying, right? That's what we do, and that's the same thing behavioral health would do. But that's something that I'm finding that I don't think we do enough, especially as chaplains, because we have this open door to talk about sin and morality and what is right and what is right for you, and we talk about moral injury. And not only what I've done to myself, but what someone else has done to me, and I'm not willing to forgive, or I'm ashamed of what they've done to me, etc. And going into that and looking and peeling back the emotions and the things that are attached to that. That's what I think.
Well, I really like that thought, yeah. And of course, you know, the views here expressed are those of the authors. They don't reflect any official policy or anything, but I really appreciate those thoughts, Chaplain. It's a dovetail with that. I would pose to the group the thought about, is what we need less confidentiality instead of more? I mean, we've gone the route of providing avenues for non-medical counseling that involved you know, your command will never know if you've talked to, you know, a military family life consultant or a provider through Military OneSource. But I feel like I've seen a lot better success, you know, in terms of, you know, maybe not a direct impact on the suicide rate, but certainly increasing utilization and decreasing hospitalizations. And that is through more direct communication with the chain of command. And that doesn't always have to be with about a particular service member. But you know, when I was running an embedded behavioral health clinic, we got out in front of a lot of scenarios because the providers had weekly contact with the military commanders, and they were able to head off a lot of problems before they reached us. Indeed, when we were consulting with commanders, non-commissioned officers in particular would take pride in saying, "Doc, we can take care of this internally. These are our brothers and sisters. We are going to make sure that they are taken care of." And you look at those core drivers of suicidality. I'm not talking about broad demographic risk factors, but the individual feelings of suicide that might be, you know, a soldier has a pay discrepancy and all of a sudden, you know, they're not going to get a paycheck for some reason. You know, those sorts of problems can easily be fixed by the chain of command if we have maybe perceived as a little less confidentiality, but we're able to directly liaison with the command and set them up in a way to have an answer for the service member and then walk them over to a tangible solution. If we say, "Hey, the first sergeant has got you, he is going to make sure this pay discrepancy gets solved," that I think, you know, to the outside observer looks like, "Oh my goodness, we told the chain of command what was going on with the service member." But inside the military culture is, "Hey, we are getting the most dedicated resource we possibly can to help and fix this problem." So again, great examples of how we're going at this from some different scenarios. Looks like some great chat here going on, a little back and forth about knowing what side of the fence someone is on. You know, Chaplain Wolf coming up on the line saying more about his example where he's a civilian first responder chaplain and you know, has had to deal with situations where you know, law enforcement and firefighter suicide also is a significant concern. They have to build relationships with those professionals so that when they're not in a crisis, you know, they're willing to come to them. And maybe, you know, they think about going to the chaplain as a resource right before moving forward with the suicide. So that is another, you know, great example. And I think per the discussion so far, it is a matter of knowing, like, what role am I in right this minute? And, you know, how does that apply in terms of the specific limits to confidentiality? Some other thoughts that are coming up here, and I'm kind of creating a question out of this. Do you ever get situations where, say, a buddy, a battle buddy, is coming forward about a specific friend? And I'm not talking about the scenarios where they're saying, "Well, a friend of mine is really struggling with this," but maybe genuine concern to say, "You know, I'm a bunkmate with Specialist Smith, and he's really struggling here, and wondering what kind of outreach could be done." Does that fit within the framework of confidentiality, Chaplain Vendros?
That's a great question, and we get that here a lot because everybody has to have a battle buddy when they're in the initial military training. And for the Army, initial military training is not only basic training, but it's also the advanced individual training. Unlike the Air Force, when they get their tech school, they're not considered a trainee anymore. But in the Army, when they're in AIT, they're still considered in phases 4 and 5 of their initial military training. And so they would always have to have a battle buddy with them. And yes, battle buddies have called their chaplain. In fact, I you know, I'm the command chaplain, and people get my number and they call me, and these privates call me, and it's fine. I'm glad they do, because I'm glad they have my number and it's a place to reach out. And so I talked to these people, and I did. I've actually had this happen twice since I've been here in the last couple of years, where a battle buddy reached out and said, "My roommate has been really been down. I think they are thinking about taking a bunch of pills. You know, what should I do?" The other person said they want to go home, and I don't know that that's a good idea for them. There was another one that I had. Oh, like somebody's parent or a friend back home ended up calling. And for my number must be the one that's on the website, because I get parents calling my number, and of course we go and run that down and we find that soldier. And but what I would say to the battle buddy is, gosh, if you're really concerned about your battle buddy, the best thing that you could do is tell your squad leader, and your squad leader can get them the immediate help that they need. If you really believe that they're in danger, I would tell the squad leader. And so that's what I've told the two people that came to me. The one actually brought the person back to me and said, hey, they really would rather talk to you. So they would talk to me, and I ended up having them call the squad leader, and the squad leader came in, and all three of us talked to the squad leader together. And so that's a great question, though, about the battle buddy. But, yes, I mean, if the battle buddy's coming to me about their buddy, do they have confidentiality? Yes, they do. Yes, they do. But that's how I would solve that or work that. Over.
All right. Just I'm reading the comment here, so everybody's got this. Response, our greatest success in combat and saving lives after injury has come by training soldiers in life support first aid. The same can be true with regard to psychological first aid. Yes, the battle buddy concept, promoted especially at the level of the squad and the platoon, especially for low-level leaders, can be very successful there. All right. In terms of exploring other pieces, I wonder a little bit about the role of chaplains in the medical setting. So, specifically for a moment that may resonate a little more with our VA chaplains about those chaplains who may get specialized training or are stationed in the hospital so that they're the ones who get called. If someone's endorsing a particular spiritual concern or, anything else that's in the spiritual realm comes up, you might get a medical referral saying, hey, we want the medical chaplain to speak here. Can you say anything about how those roles might differ for a chaplain or how they might have, some additional concern about confidentiality if, say, the physician is pulling for spiritual beliefs about a do not resuscitate order or something else that might come into the medical realm. Any thoughts there?
Well, I think Chaplain Beasley could probably speak to that as a VA chaplain. I am clinical pastoral education trained, the CPE trained, and so I have that hospital, quote-unquote, hospital training. CPE is great for anything. It's not just great for the hospital, but it teaches you how to really be present with that person and not all in about your own self. So I think the same rules would apply if there are some issues of DNR. Does that person not want to tell somebody that they're DNR? Or, I'm not really clear on what the difference would be, but I would just, again, I would walk through that person with their family and say, what are your wishes? What is it that you want people to know? And what is it that you want to keep confidential? But a DNR, that's really not a confidential document. So, but making sure that somebody has one, I think that would be important. But like if somebody says to me, I want a DNR, but I don't want my wife to know, that would be just odd because the spouse would be the one that would help implement their expressed wishes. So I'm probably not answering that question very well.
Well, I think that gets at the core, though, is that it's the same kind of scenario. It looks like, Chaplain Beasley came on the line as well. VA chaplains are supposed to keep all these conversations with patients confidential in a very similar way to what we've been saying, I think. So it puts us in a good situation there.
Thanks, Chaplain Beasley.
We've got a few others typing. I'll kind of pace for a second to give them that opportunity. I always do appreciate those opportunities to consult with the chaplain in the medical setting. Even when we would run intensive outpatient groups, when I was running a different clinic, we would have the chaplain come in on a weekly basis, and just that show that we're thinking about the whole person. The chaplain obviously was not you know, directly documenting anything in the medical record about what went on, but you know, we would have there a lot of great discussions, you know, about you know, how does this interplay work with spirituality and mental health, or we might have a specific faith group leader come in and facilitate some mindfulness training, and all of those were just great opportunities for all of these things, you know. Another just vote of confidence in what you said here. Chaplain Wolf comes on and says, I think all chaplains would benefit from the CPE, especially those in non-hospital settings.
I
so
agree.
It looks like that's a great, great training. Got a vote of confidence in that.
Thanks, Jeff. Chaplain Wolf and Dr. Wolf.
All right.
Great comments, everyone.
Looks like another one. So what can be done to enable commanders to strongly support the spiritual significance of their chaplains?
Well, I don't know if you have seen the latest legislation that just came out. A friend of mine is up at the Pentagon that was actually working on this. It kind of complements the RFRA, the Religious Freedom RFRA, I can't think of what it stands for right now, but it complements that in terms of what the chaplain is allowed to, commanders, there hasn't been consistency across the board. When you get people such as the MRFF who tried to say that, you know, a Christian chaplain cannot say such and such because it's intrusive or it's coercive, causing people to it's like a proselytization. And so this new law that just came out, I can't think of what it's called. Doggone it. I just copied it. If you Google it, it's religious liberty something. I don't know. But anyway, it just came out, and it gives commanders and chaplains more leeway in terms of, and actually all the chaplains that looked at this that I've been on chats with say, I don't see what's new here, what's new in this law, this doesn't seem like there's anything new. But what it is, it protects the chaplain from being sued or from having discrimination against them because of what they put out in an email or what they say, because they are allowed to believe and express their beliefs as well. So I wish I could find this article, darn it. I downloaded it and I have it in an email somewhere. But it definitely speaks to that, which, again, people who would look at that, they might say, well, this is no different. We've always had the freedom to express our beliefs. We're bound by what our endorser, the tenets of our faith, and we are not required to perform anything that is not in line with the tenets of our faith. So it reiterates those things, but the basic thing that it's saying is people in the military who have typically been under more I just can't think of the right word, who have typically been under the microscope more so because we're federal employees and not a pastor of a church, right? We get taxpayer funded. So as a pastor, I would have completely different freedoms than I have as a military chaplain. Well, what this new legislation is saying, that it's consistent that chaplains do have the same freedoms to practice their faith and express their faith just as anybody else does. I'm going to try and find it while we talk about other stuff here.
It looks like there in the chat, Chaplain Beasley was able to get a link there, and so I'd encourage everyone to check into that. I do like the thrust of what you're saying, though, in terms of, you know, not making the chaplain too agnostic, you know, still allowing any given chaplain to have the religious rights afforded to them from their own faith in terms of expressing those beliefs, and not having that called unnecessary proselytizing or something else. So,
right.
It looks like we've got, we've had a great discussion today. We've reached the top of our hour, and I know that everyone's got competing inboxes and other priorities teed up for the rest of their day. With that, we'll go ahead and close there. Thank you so much for everyone's continued support of our chaplain committee activities and these monthly webinars or these quarterly webinars. We look forward to hopefully seeing you at a future iteration. And please reach out directly to Christian Evans if you'd like the slides or any other materials that have been related to our presentation today. With that, we'll go ahead and close. We can ask the operator to stop the recording, and we wish everyone on the call a blessed day. We're out here.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.